I'm Max Bergman, director of the Stuart Center and Europe-Russia-Eurasia program at CSIS.
And I'm Maria Snegovaya, senior fellow for Russia and Eurasia.
And you're listening to Russian Roulette, a podcast discussing all things Russia and Eurasia from the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
Everyone, welcome back to Russian Roulette. Today we're joined by a very special guest, Roman Dobrokhotov, who is the founder and editor-in-chief of the independent Russian media outlet, The Insider. Today, Roman will be discussing the findings of an investigation he and his co-authors recently released titled Unraveling Havana Syndrome, New Evidence Links the Jero-Rus Assassination Unit to Mysterious Attacks on U.S. Officials and Their Families. We included a link to the report in our episode's show note. Roman, thank you very much for being here, and let's jump right in. So from the start, would you mind explaining to us how did you start this investigation? What was the motivation? And perhaps if you might sum up the main takeaways that are important for our audiences to understand, to get from your report.
Sure. Well, first of all, it's easy to explain our motivation because, of course, this, for me, maybe is the biggest, or at least one of the biggest stories we've ever seen as journalists, because that's something different and maybe something bigger than usual Kremlin attacks. It's not just like a dictator coming after oppositional leaders. It's not just something usual that we have already seen. That's the first time when we witness direct attack on American citizens, and not just American citizens, but diplomats, CIA agents, representatives of Minister of Defense. So serving for the state, people representing the state, and they were attacked on the territory of embassies and consulates, so like legally American territory. I have never seen anything like this before, and I don't think that even in Soviet Union anything like this has ever happened, at least on such scale, because we speak about more than 100 episodes. So, of course, when I've first read about this syndrome, about these attacks, I think there was a big story by Yulia Yoffe at some point. And it was, at first, it looked like a theory that was pretty doubtful because, you know, the scientific dimension was, for me, very, you know, weak, because I have never seen any kind of weapon that could lead to this kind of damage. So it sounded strange. Me and Christy Grozev started thinking about investigating this somewhere around 2020 or 2021, when we saw lots of strange scientists around GRU agents that we were investigating. And we saw that there were not only people who are linked with poisons or chemical stuff, but also with some radio waves and some other kind of experts. That, so why would these people constantly speaking with killing squads of GRU agents? This is a strange connection. So our attention was attracted, but it was very difficult for us to investigate this because we didn't have any access to victims. We didn't have enough information of what attacks were plausible and what is just a noise, because overall there were more than 1,000 people who said that they had some strange symptoms, and most of these people actually didn't have Havana syndrome. So it was very difficult to distinguish between real cases and just some suspicious stories.
May I just jump in? Yeah, just curious. You mentioned, by the way, 1,000. Wow, that's a lot of people to talk to. How did you know which ones had Havana syndrome and which ones did not?
Yes. So this was a challenge for us, and that's why, that's one of the reasons why we didn't even start properly investigating it before we were contacted by 60 Minutes. And this group of journalists from CBS, they were investigating independently these cases for some time. And they did have connection and communication with victims. And they already have done a big work of trying, fact-checking all these stories, trying to understand what symptoms are plausible, if we have any way of verification of these symptoms. And they found that actually there is a way to verify these stories. For example, there are special neurological tests, neurooptometrist tests, and just biochemical tests that find some biomarkers of damaged neurons. So there were some ways of testing victims that would show that this is not something psychosomatic. This is a real brain damage, and it cannot be simulated. And we have a list of people who have gone through this kind of expertise. So they had a list of the most proven cases, and there were several dozens of them. So this is already was narrowing down the story. And thus we have some concrete dates, concrete places, concrete people who we could approach. And moreover, we had two people who even saw some suspicious people. In one case in Frankfurt 2014, there was some suspicious guy who was walking around the building making photos, and he answered in some strange accent, it sounded a Russian accent, when he was stopped. So the witness remembered this high, strong man and his face. So we could check if this is someone from our guys. The same was in 2021 in at Tbilisi, where during the attack, victim looked out of the window and saw very high, blonde, thin man, which you don't see that much often in Tbilisi, at least in 2021, before the Russian wave of immigration. So she remembered him very well in this small street where usually there are no strangers. She remembered this guy standing and staring at her house. So there were two people who we could check. So that was already a good start. And we started cooperating with 60 Minutes. So this was a year-long investigation that we made together in a very intense tempo. So what we did is we compared GRU trips with this timing of the attacks, and we immediately found strong correlation. Of course, there are lots of difficulties. Like, for example, we don't have all the GRU trips for all the years. We have, for example, some concrete years for us are much more convenient, like for example, half of year of 2021, where we have all the phone calls of Averyanov, or the period between 2014 and 2018, where we have a lots of trips and phone calls of GRU agents because of our Skripal investigation. So we have like certain windows where we could check properly these trips. And in these windows, we see very strong correlation. So that was already kind of smoking gun. Then we continued and we showed these victims who witnessed some strange people. We showed them pictures of known GRU agents from 2955. Whose trips we saw coinciding. And both of the witnesses immediately recognized these people. In 2014 case, it was Yegor Gordienko, a pretty important GRU agent who at some point served as a diplomat himself. So like he undercover of a diplomat, he worked under his real name, but at that point he traveled under his fake name Gorshkov. And he was like, and is a very like a strong, high guy, and it's difficult to mix him with someone else. The same with the 2021 case, the victim immediately recognized Averyanov's son, Albert Averyanov, who also began this year working with his father, though he was very young. He's just graduated from Moscow State University. His appearance is also very recognizable. He's also very high, very thin, blonde person. And the victim said that like, when I saw him, I had this intuitive reaction. So I had immediate physiological stress because I understand that this is a person I saw. It's almost word to word what our Frankfurt victim said. She said that when I saw this guy, I felt sick, like really, I felt bad, almost this as bad as during the attack. So of course, this is not 100% proof. Because if it is the guy looks like the attacker, it still can be an emotional reaction. So, and we usually now in investigation, we don't trust witnesses because it's just how psychology works. Like people do make mistakes. So that was not enough for us. And we can also wanted to look for more evidence. And we found this evidence in leaked emails of one of the main GRU operatives from 2955, whose name is Terentyev. We found document proving that He was actually working on developing of, so it was kind of in his research called usage of acoustic weapon in urban warfare. And it was funny that actually it was anti-corruption department of Kremlin administration who demanded documents because they paid like 100,000 rubles for some work and they demanded to say what type of work is this. And he was answering that like, this is secret, I can't tell you. And they said like, still, you we paid you 100,000. So we need to know if there was some work. And then he sends this document about this, the topic of the research.
May I just jump in by saying that 100,000 rubles, right? Is that how much he's got?
Yeah, it's
not, 100,000 rubles. That does not strike me as a lot of money for innovative.
$1,000 for a research.
A new groundbreaking weapon for $10,000. Could have paid a little.
It's not like all the research itself costed that little, but his concrete paper was paid that much, so that's not a lot. But still, Russian bureaucracy, you know, you're always afraid of this if you're in the States, so you have to phone. So and he, by the way, it's interesting why he had to give all these documents. It's because he stopped working at some point as a GRU operative, because in 2018 we disclosed all this group who was hunting for Kripal, and they changed their job. They went to administration of the president, and they're now working openly under their real names with their real faces on the all the official photos. So they're working in Russian Far Eastern regions as representatives of administration of the president. So that's why this bureaucratic machine demanded all these documents from them to register them as representative of administration of the president. So yeah, that's how they failed. And but there is also another very important piece of evidence, which is that, well, for people who follow the story, they know that people who had Havana syndrome, they get a special complex of some very specific symptoms. And these specific symptoms, they are very close to an illness that is known as Meiner syndrome. Meiner is a like medicine like professor from Stanford who discovered this syndrome in the 1990s. So this is a very rare illness where your like certain ear bones damaged, and that's why you have like a complex of very rare symptoms, like your lose your balance, or you start hearing some sounds that you're not supposed to hear, like I don't know, when you move your eyeballs, or when you blink, even you hear it as a sound, so which is very very irritating and make your life very difficult. This is a very rare condition. So 0.5% of Americans have the syndrome, and only a small part of this 0.5% of people, only a small part of them have symptoms of this syndrome. So most of the people are asymptomatic. So the likelihood that you would have these symptoms in usual conditions is so small that it is just absolutely statistically impossible that dozens of USA diplomats would have it. It's just, and how it can happen that dozens of diplomats have it and people from other agencies or diplomats from other countries don't have it. So it's just impossible. So this is kind of scientific proof that these people were attacked. And if you Google Meiner syndrome in Russian, syndrome Minora, and like in Google or Yandex, the first link you would have is a link on a website where they explain how they have this unique study of this syndrome in Russia. It's the only one clinical study with some real people who came to be researched. This study was made by the only one place, which is Russian Military Academy in St. Petersburg. And this is exact the place where the people from this unit 2955 of GRU, where they were working. So GRU scientists from this concrete military unit, literally the people who were participating in these attacks in Europe, these were the same people who then studied the symptoms of this syndrome in Russia in the same time. So that does not look like a coincidence at all. one of the main also smoking guns. So if you like combine all of this in one story, many of things that were not like bulletproof argument start looking as you have actually a smoking gun. And you just can't ignore this. You can't not investigate it officially. So after we published, we immediately saw the reaction. We see that the American government is going to investigate it. And we see that the congressman already pressuring them to investigate this. So I think that we changed the situation here, because for 10 years, victims of Havana syndrome not only had very little medical care, but also the attitude to them was as they were insane people who are just imagining some paranoid stuff about being, you know, attacked by some non-existing weapons. So they were not only suffering from all these illnesses, but also they were treated as insane people. This was very painful for them. And for 10 years, many of them, and some maybe more recent cases, several years, they were fighting for some justice and some attention to be recognized as a real victim of attack of a different state. So they were very grateful that we continuing this story. And I'm pretty sure that since this moment, after investigation, there will be very quick changes and there will be real investigation now.
So Roman, maybe we could go back and start kind of at the beginning. In 2015, the U.S. government reopens its embassy in Havana, Cuba. This is sort of a big moment for the Obama administration, the resumption of ties with Cuba. This is something that I think the Russians would be quite concerned about. But then that's where the initial cases of Havana syndrome start being reported or being noticed. And I think it starts really with the CIA operatives that are there, then there's State Department officials. And the U.S. government doesn't quite know what to make of this. And then we sort of see the number of cases kind of spread worldwide. The Trump administration, you know, there's obviously a change in the U.S. government in the beginning of 2017. The Trump administration ends up closing the embassy in Havana. And then we see these cases in Guangzhou, China. There was an incident reported in London. There's one outside the White House. And this then prompted many folks that I think were skeptical both of the allegations around Russian interference in the 2016 election, you know, the quote-unquote Russia hysteria gripping Washington during this time, and describe this as sort of a psychological, as essentially this was just a case of everyone kind of hearing stories and then interpreting that that's the symptoms that were impacting them, and sort of a mass hysteria effectively. And your reporting effectively figures out or alleges that the GRU, that there's a GRU unit that you can pinpoint and say that they were effectively targeting, or that they were in the places where these events occurred. Is that a good way to sort of sum it up?
Well, yeah, just some corrections. First of all, that we know now that this attack started 2 years before incident in Havana. So at least since 2014, possibly this was not the first time. We know that the unit by itself started making some malicious operations in Europe in 2011. So it was even before the war in Ukraine, which for me is interesting because I remember that times before annexation of Crimea, before the war in Ukraine, I remember that it was the time when Russia was the part of G8. There were negotiations about lifting all the visa restrictions with the European Union. So it was a time when Russia was like quickly integrating into like European society. And of course, there were some problems because there were already some repressions that were like toxic for many Western circles. But still, Russia was seen as a country that is a part of Western family and it needs to get rid of some like problems with maybe some violations of human rights. But our official, like Russian official aim was to be integrated in this Western community. And exactly in this time, when we're discussing lifting of visas with Europe, GRU operatives are blowing up ammunition in Bulgaria, in Czech Republic, and these people already just, they're really already waging a war on the NATO territory, and NATO doesn't notice it. And even after annexation of Crimea, even after the war on the eastern part of Europe, Ukraine started, still Western countries, I think they didn't consider the option that actually Russia is already like really massively uses it, GRU units for direct attacks. So of course they already knew about the Litvinenko case, and it went without saying that Russians can like go after some its enemies who are like Russian citizens who ran from Russia, but attacking targets in the West, like some where Western citizens would suffer, that would not be considered something acceptable or even possible. But we see that in 2014, they attack American diplomats in Frankfurt already. So that shows how actually the Western community, they were blind for many years, actually. So I think that now everything's changed. So now when we start saying about like what Russia is doing, it's not really that shocking that much, the West. After Vladimir Putin saying about the nuclear war with the West, about after this full-scale invasion in Ukraine, and after many, many other things, after he killed Navalny, like I think the West now has like more or less clear impression of who Vladimir Putin is. But at that time, for many years, Russia was doing the things that was so difficult to believe. I think that was one of the reasons of skepticism about the Havana syndrome, is that for many years, it was hard to believe that Russia would cross this red lines such in such a bold manner. Even for me, it was difficult to, when I first saw the allegations, it was difficult to believe that Putin would be that much insane at 8 years. But now we have proof. We can't deny this.
Thank you so much, Roman. Very important observations. And I think one of the things that your article beautifully does is really drawing attention to how dangerous and consequential everything that's happening. Effectively, you are describing what's happening is war. But before we dig into that, I wanted to flag that I'm sure you've seen some early responses to your publication. Not all of them instantly, you know, buying that still. Perhaps it would have been naive to think that they would. But there is a number of criticism that many scholars, analysts flag, and I wanted to list those for you. Maybe you can, mm-hmm. you have a way to address them. So first of all, you know, of course, that the U.S. Intel community has come out publicly saying that they cannot confirm that a foreign country was responsible for the various symptoms associated to Havana syndrome. Plus, there are other analysts who say there's such a device that you describe is just implausible to build based on what scientific knowledge today can think of, that would have to be like the size of a truck. And essentially, there is no evidence that such weapons exist. So, like somebody, you know, who lives in the United States, perhaps we naively pride ourselves on the scientific advances here in an open society, right, the Silicon Valley and whatnot. How is it even possible that very closed-off, corrupt Russian system, which also is years, scientific years behind perhaps on the degree of high-tech development, would come up with something behind the United States, would come up with something that until now scholars in the West do not think is even plausible often? How do you address those questions?
Yeah, so let's speak a little bit about the scientific part of it. So first of all, when the Western intelligence community was asked about like what's going on, and they were asked to prepare reports, so there were numerous reports. One of the scientific reports was provided by a group of scientists, including Professor Relman from Stanford. And their conclusion was that this is actually possible, that there is so-called Frey effect, that when microwaves are modulated, the impulse microwaves are modulated in a way that the frequency of these modulated waves is coinciding with the frequency of acoustic waves. In this situation, our ear starts reacting on these waves as if it were acoustic waves. But because of this is actually microwaves, they have much bigger energy. they're just destroying ear, and they lead to this minor syndrome. This is the Frey effect and impulse microwaves. They were called the main suspect technology standing behind Havana syndrome. It was found not by us. It was found by American best experts, a panel that was created because of this call of American intelligence community. It is in their report. It's not what we are saying. We were just quoting them in the article. But yes, a year ago, when different intelligence bodies were sitting together and creating one report, first of all, in this exchange of opinion, you immediately see that different bodies have different opinions. So this not there is even a year ago there was no consensus about this. But yes, in their final report, they say that we don't have evidence that would show that there is likelihood of some foreign country standing behind this attack. So, but first of all, even this type of conclusion, it led to some disagreements within this community. So many people thought that this is a wrong way to say this. But okay, this was a year ago. Of course, they didn't have evidence that time, but now they do. So the situation changed. Now they will prepare a different report. And again, their own scientists say that actually this Frey effect can cause these symptoms. So, but now the question is only in technical details, like if this weapon can be small and how it is that Russians have them and Americans don't. So first of all, Americans do have this kind of weapon. It's just worked differently. There is a weapon that uses this effect. It's called Medusa. The result is different. So for the people who invented the American type of this weapon, the idea was to make people restrain from some territory and just to stop them. It works a little bit differently. For GRU, the aim was to make people suffer and to make them handicapped, to harm their health without the ability to prove that someone is doing this. So secretly make harm to someone's health. That was the aim. So there are different aims. Americans don't have the situation when they want secretly to make harm. Either they fight against terrorists, so they just kill them. Or they, for example, fight against, people who want to attack their building and they want just make this invisible wall through microwaves. So they have different aims. That's why they have the different weapons. And Russian intelligence, they always want to have these secret weapons like Novichok. It's very difficult to attribute it to someone before you make a very difficult study. Again, Russians are best in researching Novichok, and Western countries don't have it, they don't really need it. So that's easy to explain why these researchers, these devices are only in Russia. About whether they can be small. Yes, they can be small. The mistake about their size is often made because people don't understand how powerful this device must be. So of course, if you would treat these microwaves the same way as the microwaves we use in the kitchen, it must be very powerful because it must make things warm enough to make problem with the health. But if it was this mechanism, we wouldn't have this kind of symptoms because people would have, if they would get under real strong microwaves, that would be they would be just burned. And as we have the burned food in the microwave, they will, first of all, they possibly will die. And secondly, will have all the range of different symptoms. But here we have only this Frey effect, which is maybe not strong microwaves at all. But the problem is that they are modulated with the same frequency as the acoustic waves. So they can be very, very kind of like soft microwaves, but they still will be harmful enough for a person to have this kind of symptoms. So we don't know exactly how big this device should be, but the last what I've heard from the scientists we were consulting with, and we will, I think, write a separate piece on this in the next 2 weeks. But theory is that it can be actually pretty small. So this it can work on just a simple battery, and it can be really small. It can be disguised as a photo camera or something like this.
We're certainly looking forward to that piece. In the meantime, I'm certainly will cut down on my use of microwaves, just in case. Last question I wanted to ask you before I give this to Max. There was also this study, 5 years NIH study, that said that there was no brain damage in any of the victims. I just wanted to flag that because you explicitly argue in your paper and in our podcast that there is, right?
Yes, there is. And there are so many proof for this that it is just impossible to deny. First of all, if you test the victim the next day after, which usually was not done, which is also important. So if you test a victim like in a week, you will not find anything with a usual like blood test. But if you test them the next day, you will see biomarkers, like two different proteins, one for white matter, one for gray matter, which shows that there was a real brain damage. And this is the same biomarkers that you would find in people who had a usual head trauma, like in for football players or someone fallen from a ladder. If you didn't fell out of the window, but for some reason you have brain damage, this is strange, right? So this is cannot be psychosomatic. You would not have biomarkers from brain damage in your blood just because you're stressed. So this is one thing. Another is a neuro-optometric test where they just follow the movement of the eye, and there are some like kind of disruptions of how an eye follows an object, and this cannot be simulated. So this is an objective thing, and this was seen in all the victims. Yeah, if you just look into blood samples like a week after, or if you just look at MRI, you won't see anything because you're not looking at what you should be looking, or you just lost time and you don't see the traces. We have now many, many medical documents proving that these people had brain damage. And in four cases, it's already even proven concrete minus syndrome. So for many people, we see the symptoms that look like minus syndrome, but in four cases, we have this syndrome officially diagnosed by doctors, which is also very powerful. So yeah, I think that this information about no traces in the brain is just outdated.
Thank you very much, Roman. So this actually presents the story on the Russian side. I wanted to ask our participant, quote unquote, US side, Max Bergman, to comment a little bit as to how, Max, you see this whole weirdness of the response on the side of the US intel community. I'll just want to flag on where I come from. It was quite frustrating to see that, for example, the instances of poisoning of the Russian position, I know de facto the samples were provided, for example, to the US intel services, they would later not disclose the results of the analysis of those of the poisoning. So it wouldn't be the first time, if indeed that's the case, that the US intel is trying to say, trying not to disclose information that they both possess. Or maybe you have a different take on it. So can you please explain as to why we're seeing such really contradictory claims from the open source investigators as opposed to the US intel?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and would also want Roman's views on it as well. I mean, I guess the way I sort of look at this is that it's called Havana Syndrome in part because that's when sort of everyone became aware in 2016. But the United States was not focused very much on Russia, on Russian intelligence activities, and hence we're blindsided by Russian interference in the 2016 election. And I think we're fairly blindsided by this as well. And then what you have is a change in administration, a case in which this is not really going to be prioritized as an issue in which they're you know, you want to, any U.S. government official or senior U.S. government official during the Trump administration would want to launch sort of a high profile investigation into something that might point back to the Russians. So I think you have a lot of doctor shopping, scientist shopping, where you can find, you know, as we learned during the COVID period, you can find scientists in all different views. There's always a healthy debate there. And there was probably general skepticism throughout much of the agency and through much of the State Department about these incidents. And so it leads to, I think, just probably not much action actually happening. And then you have to ask yourself, well, what benefit does it really accrue to the State Department or the CIA if its officers are being attacked or being attacked by a weapon that you don't really have any defense mechanisms, what benefit comes from publicizing those attacks? It might deter people from wanting to join the CIA or the State Department. It might cause you different headaches. And so I think you have a combination of bureaucratic, you know, everyone's busy. Do we want to focus on this new mystery ray gun that the Russians might have? It's easy to dismiss, and there's no real benefit to each agency. And then I think if, as things started to become, I think, congeal and become more plausible, then you could even argue, well, it still benefits the U.S. government from keeping this quiet, but then perhaps dealing with the Russians directly. You know, what are we going to do to Russia to prevent them from doing this? Well, it would probably have to reside in the covert space, where we would have to take some sort of retaliatory action against Russian covert officials. And, you know, and that's not going to be made public. So I think part of that all sort of blends together into kind of what seems like a very incoherent public response. Now, what I find a little surprising is last year, the U.S. government came out and said, we did an investigation and there's sort of not much to see here, and we don't believe a foreign adversary was behind that. And I think what Roman's reporting really does is sort of blow that up again. And maybe just one sort of final point is that I find it really hard to believe. You have a bunch of U.S. government employees, and these are State Department and largely CIA officers. And these are vetted people. These are people that are vetted by the U.S. government for psychological issues. These are people who are vetted for their intelligence level. So this is like the cream of the crop, essentially, from U.S. society. And these people are also trained to observe and report and are also oftentimes deeply skeptical, deeply observant. And so the idea that like everyone is just sort of observing the same thing, I find it really hard to believe. And then you have, Roman mentioned, sort of real physical cases of similar symptoms. I find the final investigation sort of, I don't know, deeply, I sort of struggle to come to terms with it, given the quantity of cases and what they're reporting. But I'm curious for Roman's thoughts on this as well.
Well, first of all, I agree that the main problem, I think, was that America was blindsided for a long period of time about Russian malicious activities, including cyber attacks, including interference in elections, and especially in the activity of this GRU unit. Because if you see who usually were targets of these people, so that can be like former Russian spy, or yes, they attacked some munitions in Europe, but still it's something on European territory, and it was also because of Georgian war, then because of Ukrainian war. So these people from 2955 unit, they possibly were seen as people who doing some activities against their allies, but not against America. So if they would really pay attention, if they would really invest in investigating this kind of people, I think and I hope that they would be more successful than me and Christy Grozev, people who actually have no idea about intelligence. So it's more than kind of like, we're not even real professionals. It's just our hobby to investigate things. And we just use our free time to look into all these trips. And it's kind of like a nice puzzle for us. But if like two guys with their laptops can find these guys, like it's hard to believe that people who have millions of dollars in budgets, hundreds of people who for all their life trained to look for this kind of spies wouldn't find them. So it means that they were not really motivated to do this, and they just missed this, the importance of this. But it is, and I agree that it could be some bureaucratic logic that, oh, we wouldn't benefit of making it public. Yeah, there is some bureaucratic logic there, but this is actually a very, very dangerous decision, because of this, Russia continued to do this for 10 years because they were hiding the importance of this information. And actually, many of these attacks happened where there were also very, very high ranking American representatives of intelligence community, of diplomatic community. And there were some events like visits of the vice president or recently NATO summit, so where lots of very high-ranking politicians were there. Luckily, none of them were injured, but it was a possibility. And that means that for 10 years, these people were not properly defended. If they didn't do anything about it, if they didn't even admit the existence of this kind of weapons, that means there was absolutely zero defense for the American politicians in their trips abroad, right? So it was just Putin decided not to use it against American politicians, but he could do this. And it's actually so easy to defend. For example, if you are in a building with like usual walls, which most of like buildings are built, these microwaves will not come through this. You just need
reinforcement free.
Yes. So if you use this kind of walls, which is you easily can find a building with this walls to organize a meeting inside this, that will be secure enough. It's not that difficult, but you need to pay attention to this. If you ignore this, you just become you become an easy target, and that's what happened with many people. So this was not just a mistake. This if you are working for CIA or FBI or this kind of all the institutions whose duty is, or Secret Service, whose duty is to defend people from this kind of attack. And if you deliberately ignore the evidence, I don't know, it is a crime, actually. It's not just a mistake, and it must be investigated how people ignored all this evidence that they were so numerous. Okay, they didn't know about this GRU units, possibly they didn't find them, but how could they ignore these medical documents that were existing for all these years, and they just didn't pay attention to this? So yeah, I think that this must be properly investigated, and I hope that there will be some political reaction, not only towards Putin, but also towards people who were so irresponsible for all this time.
This is fascinating. Thank you very much, Roman. And I just wanted to flag once again the importance of open source investigation. Thank you for all the work that you've been doing with Chris Grozev. It's certainly not the first time that you've come certain really groundbreaking relations in your reports. And I think it's a kind of, it lines up with the ethos of the United States that openness really always trumps security, no matter whether we're talking about Russia or we're talking about the United States. We certainly remain on standby for further investigation. Some of the, in your publication, some of the interesting questions, for example, pertain to, you know, ultimately what was the goal that the Kremlin was trying to achieve by targeting those diplomats. But for today, unfortunately, that's all we have time for. Thank you once again, Roman, for joining
us
for a fantastic conversation. Thank you for all of our listeners for tuning in. As usual, if you haven't already, please subscribe to Russian Roulette and give us a 5-star rating. Additionally, be sure to check out our sister podcast, The Europhile, wherever you get your podcasts. Roman, thank you very much again. I'll be looking forward
thank
to
you
reading
for
more of your investigations.
You've been listening to Russian Roulette. We hope you enjoyed this episode and tune in again soon.
Russian Roulette releases new episodes every 2 weeks on Thursdays and is available wherever you get your podcasts. So please subscribe and share our episodes online.
And be sure to check out all the latest analysis by the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at csis.org.